welcome to another episode of Salesforce Trails and Trials, where we help you accelerate your career and turn soft skills into hard money.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. It's great to be together today for another episode of Salesforce Trails and Trials.
Now, good afternoon.
I want to know how you're doing today, but really, a major milestone has happened in your life, Mike, and so we want to hear about it and share with our audience.
Yeah, so as you know, I've been on a journey over the last year, like getting deeper into AI and building out a consultancy and going further with full stack and implementing all these different technology. I mean, even Agentforce implementation, and wasn't really sure what the next step was for my career, because I kind of had been on an engineering track for a long time, and it kind of just came full circle in the last week. So I just accepted an offer at Salesforce as a technical architect.
Cool.
I'm super excited about that. And the best part about it is they weren't even deterred that I was doing a lot of stuff away from Salesforce, because they're like, "That's great. You can tie it all together in this role. And that's even better that you're doing technical stuff like that." So I'm super pumped. And I can't wait to see what happens next.
Awesome.
Cool.
I mean,
I'm
Eric.
Still at Salesforce. I'm a TA manager. I think we're excited to have you. And I didn't hire you. It's one of my colleagues did, and lucky him.
It's wonderful. Yeah, I mean, and you know, appreciate any shout outs and all the things that led to where they landed. And it's very thankful for both of y'all for encouraging me to put myself out there and into the world and just see what sticks, you know. So thank you so much.
Yeah,
well, I think
congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations. I knew Eric would be biased toward the role, and which is good. Now, I think though there's a point of learning here. You know, one of the earlier episodes of this podcast, I think it's around 17, talks about essentially how to win your Salesforce interview. And in that podcast, that's more than just about the interview. It's about what to do before you go to the interview and what to do after the interview. And one of the aspects is essentially taking the initiative to demonstrate your capabilities in a way that can be consumed outside of the interview process. And I think one of the things that was really cool that you did is you thought, hey, I can post my CV. You know, I can post my information on LinkedIn. Everybody does that. It's pretty straightforward. But you decided to take a totally different track, which not only showed a bit of your resume details, right, what your experience was, but it did it in a way that conveyed your personality. It did like kind of your creativity, a little bit of your humor. Maybe just share a little bit with the audience, like what you did there and how you feel like it made a difference.
Yeah. So, you know, last year when I first started learning Cursor, I was like, I wanted to build a full stack app, and I kept iterating and iterating. And I was like, let me just try to do something that I think I can actually use and ship for myself. So it wasn't necessarily a full stack app then, but it was using Next.js just to kind of spin up a resume site that had a format where it could display the details from my PDF resume on a website format. And I shared it. I put it out there. I actually open sourced the first version of it, so anyone could just pull it down and make their own with it. And it created conversations, right? And I got feedback. And I just was like, okay, this is a cool little thing that I'm going to keep getting feedback on. And eventually, it grew to be what it is now, where it's got like different themes. It's got a Windows 95 desktop with a full like functional OS that controls things. I even then added a full stack piece where behind the scenes, there's a Node.js service that's hosting the AI chat with OpenAI. And it's got like a basic, you know, context structure so that it understands how to talk about my resume. And I even used a classic like AIM chat, like AOL Instant Messenger, so that you could talk to it there and ask questions. And it's something that evolved through iterations. And I was like, what's the next app? And then I was even using it for my business, where when a customer would ask, like, what can you do with Cursor? I would just in real time pull up my resume site and just say, let me add another app. And like, what do you mean? Right. And I would show them like making an app in real time, like how I prompt AI to do that. And they were so fascinated, it would close the thing. So it was more than just like, it was funny how many facets it sold. And honestly, was the final piece to my resume thing that got me into Salesforce, where they're like, how'd you do that? That's super cool.
No, it's a great point. I love it because it establishes also this one principle of kind of leveraging the same effort for multiple directions and kind of multiple objectives. But it was the initiative that you took to just do that and have a creative idea and be like, I don't know how I would do that. I'm going to go figure it out. And I think what's cool there is whoever looks at this, they don't just look at the final product. They understand, say, well, what kind of person is it that like has an idea, doesn't know how to do it, figures out what are the tools, who are the people, what's the information I need to get it done, and ultimately moves it to a point where there's something they can actually demonstrate. That sounds like a lot of what technical architects and sales engineers do. Is that right?
It's really impressive. I didn't know this is your website, Mike. I just know you through this podcast and socially, and we're on Slack together with John. And I'm looking at this website. It's the best resume site I've ever seen. And you said Windows 95. It's totally Windows 95. You got your snake app there. You've got a video. You've got like the themes, like you said. If you don't like the Windows 95, but you want to just see a traditional resume website, you just change the theme to light. If anybody goes to mikemakula.com, well, it's so inspiring. And the thing, wh whether you're looking to get promoted or hired, everybody's, let's assume everybody's a nice person. Everybody means well. But I can tell you as a hiring manager, who I hire, you could apply in 8 August. And if I have two other people in my pipeline to evaluate, I'm comparing you against them. And you need to stand out against them. You might get lucky, and I might be desperate, and I might pick you because you're pretty good, and I'll figure out the rest. But it's competitive. People are coming to Salesforce and Amazon and another company is trying to get a job. You need to show why you're different and sharp and better and make it obvious. And this website is. It connects me to your GitHub. It connects me to everything in a really creative way. And I not just this, apparently the demo you did for your interview was amazing too. So like there's a lot you're doing that's like, wow, like you have tricks up your sleeve and you're deploying them at the right time. And it's pretty cool.
Thanks, Eric. And yeah, that demo was a funny one because I had never built an integration with Slack before. So I had to use AI to like teach me and find the right documentation or fill in some of the blanks in documentation to get that working. And I was like, oh man, I did it. Like it worked the whole thing.
Well, what was it? What did you
What
demo?
was it? I don't really know what it was. I just heard good things about it.
Basically I built a chat bot that had permissions to read from a Slack channel, and then it published all the events that I gave permissions to a service that could intercept all of those chats and turn it into FAQs. And it put it in a RAG database outside of Salesforce and Pinecone so that it could determine if what it was consuming was duplicate data or not, and then send it over to Data Cloud so that Prompt Builder could find basic FAQs that Agentforce was searching for, and then the Agentforce was brought back into Salesforce, or sorry, into Slack, so that it could answer those questions. So like as you're having conversations with your colleagues, it's learning and then can answer those questions over time as people answer them.
Amazing, amazing, amazing knowledge of so many different platforms, amazing knowledge of integration of Pinecone. It's great that you know these tools that I say to anybody. I just had a conversation this week about what's it take to be a technical architect and a great technical architect. And my opinion was, you can't call yourself an architect if all you know is one product line. Like you need to know Salesforce, but you also need to know AWS tangentially. You need to know Microsoft tangentially. When I talk about Agentforce, I also really should know how does Microsoft do it? How does, AWS Bedrock do it? Because that's where my customers are. And I don't have credibility as an architect on the sales team if all I know is the Kool-Aid that Salesforce gives me, and there's a lot of it. It's great. It's great that you have this more well-rounded background. Same you too, John. Like the fact, and to be skeptical about the Salesforce products, that's great. It's we're all about a year, November, 9 months into Agentforce being released. Maybe it kind of came out at TDX like last March, a year ago, but like this is like super new and products are iterating all the time and not everything's going to work as well as other product lines from other companies right away, although I would like to say I'm actually like how it's working. So it's good to be skeptical because you know where your customers are going to come at you from.
Yeah, it's a
Yeah,
good point.
I feel like the thing that, I have to keep continuing thinking about is like, there's like the synthesized version and there's like the super technical version. And I feel like that's another super powerful skill set that sometimes I lean one way or the other and I have to dial in more, but I'm sure it's one of those things you get used to in repetition, right?
Yeah, well, John, what's your experience with that?
It's interesting. It always I, in that conversation, I always go back to, you have to test people's appetite because some people do want to challenge themselves. And so there was a guy, his name is Dan Lamott. He was I worked with him for 2 years at a group called Round Corner. They eventually sold their product to Salesforce.org or the Salesforce Foundation. Exceptional person. My understanding is that he was actually one of the people responsible for person accounts when working on the Merrill Lynch deal, like a long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Anyways, he asks people a question all the time, like in a conversation. He's like, "Hey, do you want the top of the trees or down in the weeds?" And I thought it's such a great visual to help people understand, like, what do we want right now, right? Because sometimes we want to start at the top of the trees, drop down one or two trees to the weeds, go back up, and then continue. And he would just clarify the conversation, what he's looking for, to say, "Hey, help me understand. I need the top of the trees here. What's happening?" Or, "Hey, there's one particular element here, right, with this integration with Talend. I need to go down the weeds. Like, help me understand." And I was always very helpful because it gave an appetite of clarity for anybody who's going to share, so we're not misstating to the level of detail and fidelity that we want to provide, because there is a lot. And if someone who's not ready for it, sometimes they feel intimidated, they don't want to interrupt us, they don't want to be impolite, and you can end up wasting a ton of time and attention, right? Because attention takes energy, focus takes energy, and it's really like scarce today. So
Yeah,
it is a good point.
I don't know. It's one of my experiences with salespeople. I had been a consultant for 6 years and I came over to sales engineering at Salesforce. And a salesperson persona and a sales engineer persona are different. And primarily, they're different in optimism, enthusiasm, and persistence for salespeople. And sales engineers are all about how does it work, process analysis. We're good at figuring things out, and we should be good at explaining things. However, as you know, I could tell that if I said the word API or database too many times in a conversation with my salesperson, their eyes rolled back a little bit, like they went into numb mode, because sometimes that's good and sometimes it's bad. If you the architect, if you're the technical person, whether you're consulting or a developer in IT or an admin, this appeals to applies to everybody working with Salesforce. If the person across the table for you does not care about how something works, they're gonna go into this numb tolerance mode, where they're waiting for you to finish your sentence and they're not really listening. And it took me a couple times, and I'm probably still do it wrong, but at least I think I'm aware. It took me a couple times to realize that internal itch that I have that gives me a dopamine hit when I'm able to share my knowledge with somebody else. So I can't scratch that itch with this person right now. And it just needs to be okay. I can ask the question, top of the trees or in the weeds. That's great. And maybe I'll find, I do want to say, I have salespeople who say, Eric, I don't know what you said right there, but you guys were talking your own language for like 30 minutes. But what you were saying was totally connecting. And I think we made huge progress today. And that maybe is diminishing what salespeople can do. By their own token, I give up earlier on a deal than salespeople do, because when I hear no, I kind of take it as no. Whereas they hear it as,
Not
I didn't ask the
now.
right question, not now. So it applies to everybody, and it applies, to me this day. So it's great that you're aware of it, and you will get lots of practice, because you'll be flipping back and forth between meeting with a manager of developers who are building their own full stack AI. And when as soon as you talk your talk about the things you've done in Pinecone or whatever, they're going to go, you don't just know Salesforce? And that's great, because they would rather meet a peer that they can learn something from than get a spiel. with all the marketing stuff, I avoid saying all the marketing stuff as much as possible. If not,
And Eric, that's really what I appreciate about at least this team that I'm on, is they seem to really respect that, and that fit. It actually, it's weird the how much that fits my persona, because I've always been that way. Every job I've ever worked at, I was like, look, I might be the Salesforce guy, but I was like, I want to do whatever the best tool is for the job.
I think that's a good architect perspective. You got to meet the customer, or you got to meet your company where they are. They're not ready for Data Cloud, maybe, or they're not ready for MuleSoft, or they already have Boomi or whatever. Like, let's just figure out, like, let's get you to your goals. And I know a bunch. You know a bunch. John knows a bunch. We can come in and consult, let you know how to get there and what the risks are, or the benefits. So anyway,
Yeah, another
congrats.
great analogy, just to bring this home, because I do think that this is an aspect when we when people there's a lot of people out there looking for work. And so, the audience who's listening, when you think about demonstrating your prowess, your acumen, making it visible and valuable to people, how you speak about things is a really key part of how you do that. And so another analogy is like a cooking show. So imagine it's basically at the beginning, hey, welcome, how's it going? Okay, we're pulling it out of the oven. Here it is, right? This is the casserole, the cake, the pizza, whatever it is. Look at it, smell it. Oh, isn't it amazing? Doesn't it make your mouth water? Okay, great. Would anybody like to know how we actually assembled this? What elements went in, what ingredients we used, what kind of subroutines and processes we do to bring it here. Okay, half the people might get up and say, I was totally cool with the pizza. Awesome, looks great. I'll see you guys later. And then half the people stay and they're like, okay, cool. Let's go into like, what are the pan sizes? What are the sauces? All that kind of stuff. That's the way I think about it as well, is it's so often to think about starting with the end in mind. And this, a lot of this comes from my work with a guy named Peter Kohan over the years. He wrote a book called Great Demo, actually trained a lot of the early
He trained me.
solution engineers at Salesforce. And so he's got a book called Great Demo, a great program that he does. He's got multiple people now delivering this. And I kind of, I certainly aspire to be like him with the People First Method program. But essentially, this is one of his elements, is you start with the end in mind, and then you use a series of kind of discovery and questions along the way to kind of whet people's appetite and see what they're really up for. And you're targeting the story towards the specific things that people have disclosed to you that they're struggling with. But it's brilliant, and it goes to what you guys are going to be dealing with all the time, right? Is really, it's the speaker's job to cater to the audience, not to just be clear, authentic, and consistent across various audiences. That's an incorrect way of communicating. It's very convenient, it's very efficient, but it misspeaks to roughly two-thirds of the people you're speaking to.
Makes sense.
Obviously, you touched the nerve with that one, Mike. You got us both talking about the importance of tuning your talk to the right audience.
That's good.
Because I had to really think about that when I was going into my chat, like how I was gonna frame it to like, I mean, for my final panel, I had to really think about how do I set this up so that everyone's included, because it was every type of role in that panel, and I had to, like you said, make sure I really captured enough interest in the beginning, so when I got to the nitty gritty of it, I could come back and they weren't totally gone. So it's
Cool.
a, and then there was something that there was one piece. I mean, not revealing too much here, but it's just like, how would you explain this to like a CIO or something, right? And I got caught up, but as like I kind of worked around it, and I was like, I'm not really sure, but this is what I would say, and just being honest, like, this is where I'm at. But being mindful, like there's so much, there's every little piece of the puzzle matters, like when you're trying to get into that stuff. And I think too, it's funny, I actually went and learned more stuff about that piece after the fact, because I realized when you can't say something at the highest level, there's more to learn about it.
Yeah, it's like so there's a my I had a lawyer who was a roommate, or I had a roommate who was a lawyer. I'm not sure which way it goes, but I had a roommate who was a lawyer. He told me about a law school exercise, which was a distillation exercise. Like, how do you describe what the problem is, the complaint that the plaintiff has, in as few words as possible? What is the crux of the issue? And you would go through this exercise and you would summarize, 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 summarize. Now we can actually ask ChatGPT, but that's cheating. And it is interesting to get down to like, what is this? In the end, for your example, what I'm doing is I'm making all your employees more productive by sharing the corporate knowledge that's in Slack. And I'm doing it the best, smartest, fastest way possible. And it's totally scalable. I'm just making that up.
And it's
That doesn't talk about how it works, doesn't talk about pine cone, it doesn't talk about, talks about the value, I guess.
funny because that was like my first like real slide was kind of going like, imagine just automating your knowledge base and keeping people out of answering repetitive questions in Slack. Yeah, totally.
That's good.
So that's solid. I mean, Eric, you hit the bullet, and I feel like that's, I don't know if y'all have felt this. It's like that has just been the hardest thing over time as being a technical person is you get so excited about the real technical meaty stuff. I guess Eric, you were just kind of alluding to that too, even yourself. And it's so hard to like pull myself out.
It is really hard. I mean, this is a totally, I'm, you know, with John, you talk about people first skills. This is a hard transition. This isn't just a technical thing. I know people who are detail-oriented people, and you have to be as a programmer. We have to care about the quote, the semicolon. We have to care about the efficiency of some kind of method and function and tuning it and testing it and writing tests is thinking about what are all the ways. So we are detail oriented, or we can know how to be. But it's really hard. There's another exercise that sometimes people do is like, well, write this in a newspaper article, or it's a communication topic thing. How do different people like to be communicated to? Some people want to start with the story. Oh my gosh, last Wednesday, there I was. And I don't even know where the story is going as an audience person. And I'm like, okay, and then what? And then what? And how much longer is this going to go for? I'm lost. Where are we going with this conversation? For me, I know that I like to get the headline, whether or not you're venting or need my advice, possibly if it's at work, and then tell me the story. Otherwise, I don't know where you're going. But that's so it's hard for some people to go from their experience, which is the emotional timeline of what happened, to crux of the issue, summary, and did it turn out okay? Do I need your help? Whatever it is. And that's a hard thing. My friends will talk to me. I'll be like, I don't know where you're going. Are we still talking about this? Oh yeah. Let me get back to that. You know, it's just a normal human thing to be used to communicating in a certain sphere. And you know, it's hard to adjust. I think it's called code switching.
Yeah, and one last comment I'll make on this is just even in this podcast that we're doing, we're sharing with everyone, there's a context matters. Like you asked me a question about what I built, and immediately I wanted to tell y'all the technical thing because the two technical people, that was my immediate context. But then coming back and realizing, wait, there's a broader audience that different levels here that are listening. It's just the reality of it.
Well, I think we've all experienced, that guy, that gal, we go into that setting and they're like, "Hey, I have this multi-level marketing business. Have you thought about it?" Or they have this, preference. Like some people are like, "Hey, like the whole like there's like these laser weapons and they're all coming to get us." And there's the conspiracy theory guy, or there's like these people who perseverate on these aspects. And if we're not careful, our hobby horse, things that we're super excited about, we can be perceived by some as that kind of person that just this, we're like a one track, one station radio, and this is what we like to chat about. And I think this goes back to being people first in that sense of what value can I add in this situation based on the particular audience that I'm with. Because sometimes it's like, okay, great. They can't take, some of this would be good, right? I'm going to give a dime a nickel here. I'm not going to give, like 20s and 50s of what we're talking about, and I'll just wait for them to ask for more, and we just pace it. There's a lot of maturity that comes into play there of not prioritizing my preferences in the conversation, but being very reciprocal and letting others dictate. In my course on, or when my presentation a roadmap for Agentforce acceptance, because there is no adoption if we don't first have acceptance. And it's very overlooked, in my opinion, on all of the kind of Salesforce official. They all start with ROI, which is through 3 or 4 chapters into the book. But essentially, a key factor there is the idea of being a disinterested advocate, right? We're taking people up a mountain and we have to let them define the pace. Give them feedback on the path. They're going to let us know when they need to stop and eat, when we need to make base camp because they just got their sponge full and it's just too rigorous today. The elevation was just too much today. And we need to be okay with that and say, that's okay because it's more important for me to keep you safe and on the trail than for all of us to somebody just to abandon the entire trip and be like, I can't do this. I'm
Or to
sorry.
drive them to get to the summit in the day,
Exactly. And it's
just
just
to
like,
achieve the to stick to the project plan
you
instead of
got
just
it.
help
The
them.
arbitrary.
Yeah.
Yes, the arbitrary becomes the enemy of the accessible, of what is actually possible. And that's a very difficult thing because we have a point of view, right? We have a perspective.
And we've
We
done it
have a
before, and we know
belief.
it's achievable.
Yes, we know what's feasible and what's possible, right? But we have to be that disinterested advocate and pace ourselves in our own enthusiasm, aligning to our audience, and really enlisting them in the process. So they can feel like they have agency and control over this, and they will actually as we move along, we want them to parrot and to repeat and to state those things that we knew all along are what we wanted, but people believe things when they say it themselves much more. And among that team, the people they've been working together for 15 years, when they hear it from their peers and not from us, the biased Kool-Aid drinking Salesforce folks, it's going to be much more powerful.
Yeah, totally. Do you guys
So
have Mike and John? Do you guys have story? Well, let me start with Mike first. Whether do you have a story ever of having been the expert and been frustrated when you're working with your client and they aren't believing you or they aren't just taking your blind advice? I don't know if that's ever
yeah,
happened
I mean, that's
to
happened.
you.
It's certainly happened to me. I'm just trying to think of like a very specific event.
Yeah. It happened to me one time. I was an Accenture consultant and I was working at an entertainment company and we were doing an evaluation for a document management, digital asset management application. And I had some expertise in the area. And we had had four vendors come in and, just to sum it up, I was pretty clear to me that one of the products was the leading product, and it also was the one that I was most expert in. But there were things that were not, and the other products were actually good, but when we broke it down to like what was, what we needed, my recommendation was the product that I knew. And when my client, like a senior manager that I was working with, heard the recommendation, he was like, it's not enough for you to just tell me what the answer is. You need to lead me through the path to making my own decision. And if it lines up with you, great. But that's not what your job is. And that was like sort of a harsh piece of feedback. At the same time, here I am, 22 years later, talking about like one of the best lessons that I got in consulting was from this guy who said, like, this is what I need from you. I need you to lead me. I need you to help me inform myself. And I, John, that's, I'm, yes, preach to the choir. Totally.
So
Go ahead, Mike.
the example that I just thought about is there was a company I worked for. I won't name names, but they had a different understanding of how this integration worked, with the managed package when it was installed at customers' orgs, how things were shared, how data was working, and they were kind of like, how do we get them to use it the way we've been doing it with sharing? And I did a deeper analysis. I looked at what they were doing, and I was like, we can't force like opportunity level sharing with the model that they're using because they want to move towards territory based sharing and enterprise territory management, right? Like it's not just like a switch thing. You have to really think about and plan for that, especially if your managed package is going to integrate and respect those rules. So I had to first create an entire visual to model out like how it works in the existing data model and structure, and then get everyone to understand fully how it works, and then show them like a, and this is what it would look like if we allowed enterprise territory management. And once that all clicked, I was able to POC it within 3 days, show it to the customer, and then sign a big deal and like move things forward. But it's like you have to first sometimes train them to out of what they think, because they don't see the code, they don't see how everything works, right? And this is like giving them visuals, like letting them experience it, right? This is a process.
Awesome. You sound the guy who found the gap. That's awesome.
I think my example I have is from years ago. I worked in the IT department at the American Film Institute here in LA. And it sounds prestigious, but it wasn't great. It was interesting. I learned a lot, and I think that's the benefit there. That's actually where I got my first foray into like deeper into Unix, because we were using AIX, which was a Apple form of Unix, which was fun, and got into FreeBSD. But the example was, as I would get called, like for example, into the CEO's office, and there's some printer problem or whatever. And she'd be very annoyed and frustrated, right? Like I could sense that when I came in the room. She's just like, this is your fault, blaming me. This is a delay. I need to get this done so I can get moving. And I would, and my, at the time, my way of dealing with it was to like just be clear about like, oh, okay, well, the reason this happened was, like there's this connectivity. It's like, maybe it's wireless and sometimes it loses its way on the network, or it goes to sleep, or, like this is what you do with your computer. And then by you switching networks, it makes it so that you're, blah, blah, blah. And I could just tell, like, the way that she was looking at me, she's just like, I don't care at all. And sometimes it was like, if I had something close to me, I would throw it. That's what I felt like. And so that was a clue for me to be like, all right, this, there are people who I'm kind of an altruist in some ways. Like, I think, doesn't everybody care? Like, isn't everybody curious? And don't they want to? And it's not true at all. Like, most people don't. And part of that is very disappointing for me. But at the same time, it was a really important lesson that I really need to know my audience, and so I can be brief, and I'll just fix the issue, and then while it's printing, be like, hey, cool, do you want to know how you can avoid this in the future? Because some people are gonna be like, no, I don't care. It's like, okay, I'm not gonna change them. And I think that's the key, is that I'm here to, I have a specific task to do, and I'm not gonna change the world. I need to just do that task and then invite people, if they're willing, to like learn from that or take from it or gain something. But if they're not willing, I can't make someone eat that's not hungry. So I'm not gonna waste my time and my energy to do that.
I guess my story was a little different in the sense that like I get super involved with like if that one person wasn't interested, I brought more people in the room and it was a full group conversation, and then it's kind of like group authority kind of overrides like the decision. But I mean that's just another way to
That's a
cut the
good,
it's
it's a
you don't
good,
always have that option, but
no, yeah. I think it's that was probably socially observant. And creative of you to do that. So, yeah, good.
No, it's good. For sure.
Is that another people
Well,
skill? We talked
huh?
about that one. People first. It's not about one person. Sometimes it's about many people in a
Oh, it's
room.
often about many people, absolutely. And I think what Mike mentioned there's a lot of group dynamics that come into play, and that's going back to your idea of like being an architect, right? So like learning about other platforms, you can't always go down into the weeds, but you can do top of the trees. And I really focus on feasibility conversations, like understanding where the limits are to these things and where their kind of value prop starts to fade. And that's really, and I think, an important starting point. But the group dynamics is, I believe, a very underappreciated value of someone like an architect who's often leading and facilitating conversations. You have to be able to recognize what's going on with people, who's interested, who's not. And this like go even back to like how AI can be helpful and not helpful, because you have to recognize like there's certain people at this meeting who are not talking. There are certain people who are not at this meeting that should be. They're being mentioned, maybe positive in a negative way, right? There are certain aspects of why are other people interrupting other people? Why aren't they letting them finish? There's like, very high tenure, long-term people in this organization who are not speaking as though they have the authority, though they do. There's something going on politically that's happening. So these group dynamics, in my opinion, because they're the top three reasons, top 10 reasons actually, why projects fail, it's so important to have the insight and the lenses that we're looking through to be able to recognize when they're occurring, because they are our biggest risk in the project, not the technology, though we need to be cognizant of both.
That makes sense.
I was so ignorant about all this stuff. I came out of college. I was an IT consultant. I could program, but I was so blind to all this stuff. I just, maybe I was so consumed with just doing my basic job. And it's just once you master the basics of your job, then you can start to think about the other things, that are the derivative or the other context things that are happening in the room. But just looking back on like me, my first, I don't know, I would be open to saying I'm a late bloomer. I just, there were people, it's just, it, I'm just surprised. Like, look back, like, God, I did not know any of this. I was not aware about this for like, and I thought I was pretty good. No.
I think we all have those retrospective conversations being like, I never thought I was that dumb.
Oh gosh, man.
So, you know what's kind of interesting about my story is this isn't the first time I quit my job without having another job lined up. So kind of what sparked my whole career was that's what I did a decade ago. I quit my first job after 4 years without having another job. And it was that experience over like 6 months of like pushing myself to learn every possible, like going every direction and like beyond, like just so much content absorbed. It's crazy. You don't realize how much time you have till you quit your job and that's your only responsibility. And you go through like rapid learning. And if you've never done that or had the opportunity to experience that, whether through layoffs or other things, right? Like it's an interesting time.
So you just got into Salesforce, but before that, you had 6 months where you were just learning, doing, trying, building your resume, consulting. What is that what you're
Like
saying?
10 years ago, you're talking
No,
about?
just you said this isn't the
Oh,
first.
this last time. Yeah, because I left my last job in October. And then I spent a couple months like doing interviews, and there were some jobs that wanted return to office, so it didn't work out. I was really excited about. And then it was January, I decided to start consulting because I was like, well, I'll just start consulting until I find the perfect job. And it ended up being a long journey. It ended up taking, till August now to find that perfect job for me. But yeah, I just kind of just went deep into it.
Cool.
It's very good. Well, it's good. I'm on a similar journey a little bit right now, right? Just looking to diversify a little bit and focus in, because things have been on the SI side have been slow for all of my partners and for me in the mid-market since probably August of last year. It very much corresponds with the introduction of what I would consider the bright headlights of AI into the eyes of the Salesforce ecosystem, especially this size. Like mid-market doesn't have money to waste, maybe like the enterprise does sometimes. But I wanted, there's one news item I wanted to get your guys' perspective on this week, which was you may have seen that Cornell came out this week with a research report highlighting that hallucinations are actually impossible to prevent in AI by nature of how the LLM is structured internally. And the essentially in a nutshell, I think if you think about given by how it's organized, the math it uses for like what are the potential possibilities, that number is always higher than the number of actual possibilities within the probability math. So therefore, if it thinks that there's 20 options available, but there's actually only 15, those five, it will assert with full confidence on its own independent model. They're not actual possibilities, but it doesn't know that because it always crafts, there's more possibilities. Essentially, it's like it's creativity in a sense. There's always more possibilities it believes than there are actually existing. And so it's just a problem. You can see where it lines up with the percentages of how often it happens. It depends on what that number looks like. I just think it's interesting that, because there are people who are working beyond LLMs now. Like they've moved beyond this now into aspects around physical space and things like that. I wanted to just highlight a little bit of a of curated path of, given this issue, right, of hallucinations, how big do you think the risk is for organizations? Are there certain types of AI that would be better starting points given that reality? Because those can be handled, for example. And just to provide guidance for people who are looking to try and make inroads and say, hey, how can we take advantage of this really cool technology, but do so in a way that just doesn't make me lose sleep at night? Because I think in small and mid-market, like we're still dealing with that people are still very afraid. And research like this certainly validates that there are concerns in certain areas. But I just thought it'd be good to highlight some areas that would be good places to say, okay, even if that's true, there's some really good benefits here in certain areas.
Sorry, my first immediate thought is just that it's kind of like using Google Maps. I can't tell you how many times, like in my life, where I didn't even think about where I was going. I just put it in Google Maps and I let it take me on the journey, and it wasn't quite right. And it took me on some different paths that I didn't expect to go on. And it could have ruined the whole day if when there was traffic or something. Versus, I thought about where I'm going. I looked at where I'm going. So I had a baseline that I could then benchmark as I'm on that journey that I'm letting it pr kind of predict. And I feel like that's the thing that we have to think about when we're using these tools, always, like for now.
Yeah, it didn't lead you into the lake like Michael Scott, right?
Well, I had some people for my wedding that just didn't look the logistics, and we put it on the website, we put all the instructions and everything else, but they put in Google Maps and they ended up paying like $60 for parking. I'm like, we paid for all the parking, it's underground.
Oh, wow. It's a good point, though. So I think just to highlight what you're talking about there, you're stating that, yeah, even something like Google Maps might lead you to the wrong place. You don't want to just rely on the fact that, oh, it got it right and I'll know it when I get there. But rather, you can check out the route in advance. You can kind of see as you're driving along that, hey, this looks to be a similar route that I would expect. Versus, it seems like we're kind of going the wrong direction and we're off, and I need to do a little course correction.
And it just gets you because sometimes Google Maps, maybe the last 10 times it worked out perfect, but then that one time happens where everything was messed up and you really needed it to be right.
Yeah, it's a good example.
And then
So
obviously there's this, oh, one, the one last bit I'll say is like, then there's an opportunity for some service to come in and have that self-correcting logic on top of it, but that's where it's beyond the LLM.
Yeah, and I think that's the key there is that, AI is moving into the basement here, and we need to be elevating our own kind of human experience and insight so that we can provide that level of oversight. Right. What are your thoughts, Eric?
My experience, so hallucinations do exist. Hallucinations are not only some completely fictitious things, like the early examples with RAG was how do I make a perfect pizza and you put glue on it. It was trained maybe by a food photographer, and they do use glue as meat. So like there's a foundation, there's a root to this hallucination that came from somewhere. That's a hypothesis on my part. I think that's why glue came up. Glue is used on in cereal ads for the milk, Elmer's. So that's one kind of hallucination. Another kind of hallucination is you so to avoid completely depending on the model and to try to get more accurate, people started using RAG. So I'm going to find facts that I know to be true that I can choose from. I'm going to send that to the LLM, and I'm going to use a RAG-based model for my model. And hallucinations are still possible there. An example is, I just saw a YouTube channel this week where this guy was talking about the importance of chunking properly when you load documents into your vector database. And so you might have a legal document that's showing a contract that says, see Appendix F for the exceptions to when we will indemnify you for downtime. But in page two, before the appendix, it says, we generally do not indemnify you for downtime. So if you just simply chunk the document up, there is a seemingly accurate answer on page one or where the first occurrence of
The
the
fragment.
ramification of the fragment comes up, that is a really great match for retrieval. And the agent will come back and say, we don't indemnify for downtime, as an example. So the original question was, there LLMs will still they will likely won't LLMs still have hallucinations? It's really hard to prevent in within just the LLM. I think the answer is you can't, and you guys may know more than me. I've never built an LLM. I've never trained one.
Me neither.
And I don't understand really why you would, unless you're building a knowledge, a domain-specific knowledge base that does not exist in OpenAI. Does anybody
It's very
disagree?
expensive. It's very expensive to
Very
do that, by the way.
expensive. You need a $400,000 a year engineer to do this. And but give assuming you have those two things, is there another reason why you'd build your own LLM? It's only if the OpenAI and whatever models you want to use don't encompass that data already, right?
Well, I
Well,
mean, go ahead, Mike.
I thought the idea of smaller models is it could be kind of like the thing that holds the bigger model accountable. Like the bigger model might find something and then the smaller model could step in to,
I like that.
dive deeper.
That's good. So you can have monitoring LLMs. Maybe that's there's a better term for that, but
Evaluators, monitors,
evaluators. Yeah. So what? So I think the best step towards avoiding hallucinations is to use some kind of RAG to use, and at which point, when you're doing that, you're mostly just using the big LLM as a grammar engine, a composer, and all the facts. And it's also an evaluation machine, a decider based on the details provided in this JSON document and the following knowledge articles that come over, pick the one that's relevant, and it'll actually take all that input, and the prompt will generate something that's seemingly, hopefully, fairly accurate. So I think RAG is the first step to minimizing the hallucinations. I just heard today we had a call internally with one of our engineers working on agents with our customers. And one of the takeaways was agents just require a lot of testing because, and it can be things like you have 11 instructions on a topic and you find out you need a 12th one. And there's something it does to the overall system that then requires you to retest that agent again, because it's not like it's a it, that those instructions exist in the context of each other. It's not like you're adding a net new instruction that it won't impact the context that that topic's going to work in. So I think the third point is, I think just no matter what, you need to plan your deployments with more testing. And the fourth and last thing I'll say is you need to look at your agents. And we have a model in Salesforce for what a level one, level two, and level three complexity agent is. Level three and four is agents talking to agents, making callouts to third-party systems. But a level one agent is an FAQ agent. You need to learn how to run an agent by choosing a level one example, or maybe a level two where it's querying Salesforce, because there's stuff you need to know, like how to test, how to modify my instructions, how to monitor and audit the performance of the agent going forward. And you don't have those skills. And until you have them, you shouldn't take on a level four or level three agent. So I don't think there's a lot of risk. A level one agent's read only. A level two agent, you're doing things that are, maybe more, you're integrating to APIs or connecting to Salesforce or modifying orders or looking up our opportunities. And you have security concerns to learn about. The risks start to appear once you start worrying about, am I making financial decisions? Am I exposing PII? Am I modifying important documents in the system? That's where risk exists. But level one still has the risk of chunking. Maybe you didn't load your documents well into RAG. So I guess I'm agreeing, yeah, these risks exist. And they can be mitigated through testing and RAG. I think that's what everybody needs to do. And it's not even a Salesforce specific thing. It's I only know really Salesforce at a weeds level. Mike, John, what do you guys think?
Well, I would add
I
to your list there, there are, when you think about risk, certainly I think there's aspects where we would, even if we could, things are technically feasible and we could solve the data security aspects, that there's just some elements that we would want to retain from that people first perspective, right? I think of the, like the, what I like about the example that Mike gave, for example, with his demo with Slack, is that the questions are being posed to people in Slack, and the agent is there at backstopping and saying like, "Hey, while you're waiting for an answer on this, I have a couple things here from people prior that have gave." So I love those kind of co-op AI examples that really don't, they don't disintermediate the human experience. They complement and they
It
accelerate
augments.
the human experience. And I think there's a lot of use cases that people perceive with agents that disintermediate, that they disrupt and begin move toward omit the human experience. And so I think we just have to be really careful and curate those.
Yeah, I've heard the term human in the loop. Mark Benioff talks about, agents and humans together. I think most of us would advocate more for, how can we have agents augment a human by pre-processing records and data before it gets to them, suggesting classifications, summarizing for them, finding additional relevant documents that are needed to help make the decision, proposing a response of some kind or an action of some kind. I think that is, I mean, that is also a super way to mitigate the risk is, don't assume that your agents will be 100% autonomous. We benefit if we just make people faster.
That's true. Yep. Mike?
Sorry, I lost where I was going to go. That was really good points you were just making.
Thanks, thanks, thanks.
Yeah, no, it's really good, and I think that's your encouragement on level one and level two are important because people really somewhere people need to get the experience of what is it like to do this? How do I iterate? How do I test it? How do I get that confidence in actually having some sense of, and for us, right, just putting together just a sidebar, right? Ever since I did the snake game with Mike months ago, I've been doing all kinds of little projects in Clime in VS Code. And my latest one is my second iteration of, like my people first mentor, basically, like people who've gone through the course, a kind of text interface that just helps them to say, oh crap, like what are four strategies to deal with an angry stakeholder again? Right. And it just leverages all of the course material and all that stuff. And it's basically a RAG database that just answers based on that. Which is really interesting, but it definitely scratches that itch on my part with the development side. And so for me, doing these things, like even though I may not ever do anything with it, I mean, to date, let's see, I've spent $8.50 in about 6 hours. Just the idea of like, this is what it takes to do it. This is how I go test it. This is how I verify it. This is how I put in a human in the loop kind of improvement system related to it so I can give feedback. And just seeing what's possible, going back full circle back to the architect element, I think it's so important that we have an imagination for people, that we're providing vision demos and vision conversations as much as we're providing feasibility, guardrails, limits, and such, helping people recognize that I'm here to help you with what you don't know, so that you can go back and make the decision about what you would like to do based on now what you know. And I think that's also a representative case for what a lot of AI can do for us is properly inform people in a much more succinct and accelerated way so they can actually be the real agent in the process, making the decision and deciding what's best for the people, for the audience, for the pace. The AI itself is almost like a disinterested advocate in the process. Not forcing its way, but just informing and letting people go at their own pace.
Yeah, well said. I think that's good. And you have some experience now for $8.50, and in your time, like, you've got perspective, so that's cool.
For sure. I'm going to
Love
share
that.
it. I'll share it with you guys because I want to get your feedback on. I've done it all without Pinecone, without any tools, and I want to see, hey, what are some good ways to enhance it to make it even better.
Love it. I'd be happy to.
Awesome, guys. Well, another great week, and we appreciate everyone for listening in on our conversations. Please feel free. You can post on our socials if you want us to cover a particular topic. But we're excited to continue the journey with you, Mike, and joining the mothership and making it better for all of us in the ecosystem. And Eric, as you continue to do your work and train your teams, and it's super important. I love that Salesforce is bringing back well-architected and really getting focused on empowering architects to really be great leaders in the ecosystem.
Great.
Thanks, John.
Our pleasure. All right.
All right, have a good week.
Well,
Thanks,
have a good
everyone.
week. Thanks for joining us on another episode of Salesforce Trails and Trials. If you found this episode valuable, we would love your help reaching others. Please subscribe, leave us a 5-star review, and share this with another who would benefit.